World News Today, brought to you by the Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations, as well as leading news centers of our own country, CBS correspondents are waiting to bring you a complete report from the world's political and battlefronts. But first, here's Doug Edwards.
American daylight bombers were busy again today. Our liberators, with fighter escort, have continued the air offensive with another sock at German coastal installations in France. Mud and slush are hampering the Russian armies from Estonia to the Black Sea, but the Germans report a big new Red Army push toward Romania. A dispatch from Turkey says the Germans have begun another general offensive against the Yugoslav partisans, and in the Pacific, American troops on Los Negros and the Admiralties have killed 3,000 Japanese in one of the fiercest battles of the war. Now news of the fighting in Italy and an interview with a flyer from Detroit. Admiral Radio takes you to Naples, John Daly reporting.
Bogged down in mud, which forced all movement onto the roads, where any major activity would have been easy prey for artillery, the land fronts in Italy were quiet today. And once again, bad weather severely hampered air operations. Patrols and artillery were active in the casino area, and the Germans maintained steady pressure at several points on the periphery of our Anzio beachhead. But no new major enemy attack appears to be shaping up. The Germans haven't yet recovered from the beating they took from Allied artillery in their midweek offensive, nor from the terrific Allied aerial blitz last Thursday, in which every type of aircraft participated to deliver the greatest ground-air support assault of the Mediterranean campaign. It was a final punch, after which the German attack petered out. Captain Nicholas J. Cassoon of Detroit led a fighter-bomber squadron of A-36 invaders in that aerial blitz. They followed the fortresses and liberators, which had already dropped a record 40,000 fragmentation bombs on German positions. When did your outfit go in, Nick?
We were probably the last attacking force, and we nearly lost our chance. Our target was a wood southwest of Cisterna, about 500 yards ahead of our own lines, where German tanks and infantry were hiding out. When we got over Anzio, the whole target area was shut out by overcast. But we found a hole in the overcast and saw a familiar landmark. We knew it was about 7 miles from our target. That gave us a chance, and although it meant we'd have to change our bombing tactics, we took it.
Well, how did you change your tactics?
There's a lot of German flak stacked up in the beachhead, and the plans called for dive bombing. We were supposed to go in at 10,000 feet, roll over, drop our load, and get out. Letting down through that hole in the overcast meant we had to make a low-level attack. Some of my squadron went in on their bomb run as low as 300 feet. But they did a good job. Six pairs of 500-pound bombs slapped right into the wood, and a lot of them landed on German positions around it.
Well, was it very hot, Nick?
It certainly was. I think those Jerrys were even throwing rocks at us. One of the ships had a rock in its wing when we got back to the base. They opened up with heavy stuff as soon as we let down through the overcast. By the time we turned into the bomb run, they were throwing everything at us. It's the heaviest small arms barrage, machine guns, and rifles that I've ever flown through. I came into the target at about 400 miles an hour, parked the bombs in the trees, and then hit the frenzy button.
And what's the frenzy button?
That's what we call a throttle. And when things are as hot as they were at Anzio, you push it as far as it will go and then bend it.
Well, you seem to have taken most of the fight out of Jerry anyway.
I guess we did, John. We have what we call a bomb line. In effect, it separates our front line from theirs. And when the squadron went up to Anzio this morning, the bomb line was just the same as last Sunday.
Now back to CBS in New York.
More news in just a moment, but first here's Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral Radio.
The morale of the men who are winning our battles on all fronts is all important to their leaders. News from home ranks first on the morale-building list, and radio is a principal means of bringing them this news. Admiral Corporation is proud to tell you that American radio manufacturers have supplied thousands of compact shortwave sets that bring Main Street to the boys in all parts of the world. Sporting events, Hollywood gossip, the opera, political highlights, favorite comedians and dance bands, the boys get them all by shortwave radio. Every day, Admiral and other manufacturers are producing and shipping tremendous quantities of radio equipment for military uses to hasten victory. New standards of precision have grown out of a need for better war communications equipment. Admiral Corporation assures you these same new standards, which seemed impossible before the war, will be used when Admiral's vast productive forces are turned to building a new and better Admiral radio, America's smart set. Now here once again is Doug Edwards.
Allied planes from Britain, including our liberators, were over France again today. For this news and an interview with one of our fighting men from Texas, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS London. Richard C. Hottolett reporting.
The 8th Air Force has brought the Blitz to Berlin in daylight. And when I say Blitz, I don't mean only bombs. I mean our Lightning fighters, too. Day before yesterday, our P-38s penetrated deeper into enemy territory than any fighter has ever done. It's 1,200 miles round trip from England to Berlin. Lieutenant Colonel Jack S. Jenkins of Levelland, Texas, led the first formation of Lightnings to Berlin on Friday and went there with the bombers again yesterday. How did you feel on that first long flight, Colonel?
Well, cold, mainly. We had temperatures of 56 degrees below zero. And when you're that cold, you're really shivering. The old Lightning didn't seem to mind, though. She just purred along. It was more than 1,200 miles. We not only flew to Berlin on Friday, we flew around the city and went on further east and went south to Leipzig before we came home.
Must have done something terrific to the plane to give it that range.
Well, I'm not allowed to tell you what makes it tick, but for my money, it ticks better than any fighter plane in the world.
And you're the man to get the best out of it, Colonel. You've flown 31 missions in it, and you've shot down two Germans with a couple more probables. Did you have any trouble these last trips?
My gang had no trouble at all, except for the weather. Looks to me like we're a top dog over Germany already. We still get trouble, sure, but our fighters can go pretty nearly anywhere they want. Our bombers are meeting a lot less fighter opposition, too. You know, we sit around this station now and then and talk about old times, 3 or 4 months ago. Like the Bremen show last November when we got hit by 300 Jerry fighters. That was a bad dream. Now it's a milk run. And when Bremen gets to be a milk run in 3 months, that's pretty good.
What's the reason?
There's one main reason. Our bombers and the RAF are hitting the German aircraft industry so hard and so fast that they just don't have the planes to put up anymore. You watch and see. It won't be long before our losses to enemy fighters level out at a figure even lower than it is now. I'm not surprised. I've seen the beating their factories take. You should have seen the Gotha fighter plant that we bombed last week or so ago. Down below were the buildings and about 100 planes in a dispersal area. And our bombs hit. Wham! In a couple of minutes, and when the smoke had blown away, there was nothing there. That was precision pinpoint bomb. Gotha was a plant like Lockheed. It was wiped out. You know, there have been a lot of communiques in this war that said one objective or another had been destroyed or annihilated or something, but you never seemed to see any direct practical results. Now, flying over Germany, we see the direct results of our offensive. And that's the payoff.
Thank you, Colonel Jack S. Jenkins. I return you now to New York.
And now for news on the home front, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS Washington. Don Pryor reporting.
Senator Truman's committee has issued its third annual report on the nation's war production. The committee says that American industry has passed its most crucial test and from now on can afford to concentrate on high quality in the production of specialized items like landing craft. More civilian production is in sight, and the report says the emphasis should be on farm machinery. The Truman committee also reports, also takes a crack at proposed national service legislation, maintaining that problems of manpower are much too difficult and complex to be solved by mere draft of workers. There's no late news here from Argentina, since Acting Secretary of State Stettinius yesterday accused that country of still being a base for Axis espionage. The charges made by Stettinius have the effect of leaving it up to President Farrell to prove that his new regime isn't Axis-inspired. Representative Robertson of the Ways and Means Committee indicated today that it may be several months before simplification of tax returns will be possible, and the Agriculture Department says next month's meat supply will be smaller than it is now. I return you now to Admiral Radio in New York.
The Red Army today is meeting more opposition from the weather than from German troops. A great thaw has turned the battlefields from the Gulf of Finland to the Black Sea into a deep, sticky mud, and slushy swamps and streams are impeding the advance of the Russian troops. The German High Command reports, however, that the Soviets have broken the enemy lines in the Sheptakovka sector in a new push toward Romania. The Russians are said to have attacked with superior infantry and tank units. Now for a summary of the situation on the Russian front, here is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
As Mr. Edwards has just told you, the Germans admit that the Russians have broken into the German front in the Sheptakovka area. This is on the south face of the long, thin Russian salient, which thrusts out into the southeastern corner of old Poland, with the Privet Marshes north of it and the German southern armies on the other side. The tip of this salient has for some time been holding the important railway junctions of Ravno and Lutsk. About 10 days ago, the Germans launched an unsuccessful counterattack in the region of Lutsk. This attack appeared to be made in wholly insufficient strength. It was sharply beaten back. The situation was one made to order for a German counterblow. Whenever the Russians have in the past effected such a deep, narrow penetration, the Germans have struck viciously at the flanks of the salient and often have succeeded in reducing it. There is the greatest need for the Germans to do something of the sort in the case under discussion, for it seems impossible for them to reconstitute any sort of consolidated defensive front in Russia unless they can reestablish easy communications between their central and southern sectors. Such communications are now interrupted by this Russian penetration. Yet, when they strike a weak and ineffective blow. And now the Russians are themselves on the offensive again in the same general area. That means that the Germans have given the Russians time to build up their communication system, to bring forward men and material. They would never have allowed this to happen if they could have prevented it. Hence, one can only draw the conclusion that Field Marshal von Manstein does not have enough troops for the purpose of putting on an effective counterattack. Inevitably, this leads to the question, have the Germans been compelled to miss the boat in South Russia in order to find troops for reinforcing their Italian front? It seems very likely, though it's possible that the weather, which has brought the spring thaws a little early to the Russian front, may prove the Germans' friends in Russia, just as it has already done in Italy.
That was Major George Fielding Elliott. The USS Refuge, newest of the Navy's hospital ships, is at Baltimore now, about ready to join the fleet. For a report on her and an interview with Vice Admiral McIntyre, the Navy Surgeon General, Admiral Radio takes you to the USS Refuge, Bill Slocum, Jr., reporting.
This is a strange and pleasant assignment for these unhappy days. I'm aboard a sleek and sturdy instrument of modern warfare, which is not designed to kill, but to heal. It's the Navy's newest hospital ship, the USS Refuge. The Navy is very proud of this seagoing hospital, and proudest of the new ship is Vice Admiral Ross T. McIntyre, who, as Surgeon General of the United States Navy, is charged with the medical care received by all our seagoing fighting men and the Commander-in-Chief at the White House. Admiral McIntyre has taken time out from showing this new ship to an official party from Washington to talk briefly about her to us. Admiral McIntyre, would you tell us something about this new Mercy ship?
She will comfortably care for about 630 patients and many more if necessary. She carries a 72-bed mobile field hospital and the very newest and best of hospital equipment.
She certainly doesn't look much like the usual U.S. Navy ship.
That's done with a purpose. If you'll look aloft, you will see the Geneva Red Cross painted on her smokestacks. Along her hull runs a green line 5 feet wide, and you will note a red cross in the center of the ship. And this is the international sign of a hospital ship. She will be fully lighted at night and will travel unescorted at all times.
In your office, I saw pictures of an old sidewheeler, the Red Rover, and the new Solace. Tell us something about them, Admiral.
The Red Rover was the first hospital ship in the United States Navy. Admiral Farragut used her on the Mississippi during the war between the states.
And the USS Solace?
She is one of our present-day hospital ships. All these Mercy ships are doing a splendid job, and the Solace is typical. She was at Pearl Harbor and has been in constant action since. Thousands of wounded have been cared for on board the Solace, and yet, her mortality rate has been less than 0.5%.
Well, let's hope the Refuge maintains that standard, but with many fewer patients. Admiral, Americans are slowly learning of the heroism of Navy hospital corpsmen. Tell us something about their work.
The Navy is very proud of its hospital corpsmen. They've done great work nursing the injured aboard ship, but the job hospital corpsmen have done on the beaches of Guadalcanal, Tarawa, in Africa, and other landing places has become immortal. Ask a Marine.
I don't have to ask them, Admiral. They've told me. How about the personnel of the Refuge?
In the main, it is composed of doctors, dentists, nurses, hospital corpsmen, and other enlisted men of the Navy, many of them fresh from civilian life. The commanding officer and the senior medical officer aboard are veteran Navy men, however.
And just one more question. Your patient in the White House has recently returned from a brief vacation. There was some talk that his health was not of the best.
I'm glad to tell you today that the President's brief rest has returned him in the finest possible health. He is in perfect shape.
Thanks very much, Vice Admiral Ross T. McIntyre, Surgeon General, United States Navy. I know everybody listening joins me in wishing the officers and men and women of the USS Refuge good sailing. I return you now to Admiral Radio in New York.
Admiral Radio takes you now to CBS Pearl Harbor. Webley Edwards reporting.
Among the carrier forces that attacked Truk and the Marianas was Air Group 9, one of the hottest of them, and a veteran outfit. With me here right now is the skipper of that group. He's Lieutenant Commander Phil Torrey, Jr. of Washington, D.C. He's the son of Major General P.H. Torrey of the Marine Corps at Quantico, Virginia. Commander Torrey, will you tell us about the Marianas attack?
On all the attacks our group has made so far, including Truk, we've managed to surprise the Japs, so this was the first time we'd ever been discovered before we hit. This Jap plane picked us up before noon of the 21st. And that afternoon and evening, he and his brothers came back. We had a pretty rough night, but the anti-aircraft boys shot most of them down without any damage to our ships. The next morning, our early takeoff was delayed by a dive bomber and torpedo plane attack, but we got to the target on schedule in spite of that. The weather was pretty bad, and it was stormy over the target at Saipan. Fortunately, we found a hole in the storm over the airfield, and our fighters went in and found about 20 Jap planes on the ground, which they immediately strafed and destroyed most of them while the bombers were going for the hangars and installations.
Commander Torrey, how do you account for these Jap planes being caught on the ground when they knew you were coming?
That's hard to understand. Another carrier air group caught 50 planes on the ground at Tinian and shot up most of them. Maybe they thought the bad weather protected them. That's not very reasonable, but it's the only thing I can think of.
Could it have been that they didn't have enough pilots, that this might have been a staging base?
Well, that's possible. Saipan looked like a staging base. There was no large-scale construction there, and it didn't have what I'd call a first-class Jap airfield. I would say from our photographs that it wasn't a large-scale naval base.
Tell us how it was up over Saipan.
The weather made dive bombing difficult. They had to slow down and flatten out. There didn't seem to be much anti-aircraft, and our planes knocked down every Jap plane we saw over the target. Later, our group went back and hit shipping in the harbor.
I recall that your group 9 hit Rabaul last November and got 55 Jap planes there. How'd you compare the Marianas setup with Rabaul as it was then?
So far as anti-aircraft is concerned, Marianas are not in the same ballpark with Rabaul the way it was then.
How are their pilots here at the Marianas?
Good? No.
How about the effect, the overall effect of the attack?
I can't say what the long-run effect will be, but we don't think we left them much there because they didn't chase us that night, the evening of the 22nd. And that's a pretty good indication they were knocked out, for the time being at least.
That's the word from Lieutenant Commander Phil Torrey, Jr., commander of Carrier Group 9 in the attack on Truk and the Marianas. This is Webley Edwards at Pearl Harbor, returning you to Admiral Radio in New York.
And now for another interview with a Marine sergeant who saw 22 months of action in the South Pacific, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS Washington, Don Pryor reporting.
When Major, now Lieutenant Colonel, James P.S. Devereaux and his 378 Marines were making their historic stand on Wake Island in December 1941, one of the most avid listeners to the news was a 19-year-old student in a Washington prep school. He was Major Devereaux's nephew, John R. Devereaux. And here he is, now a sergeant of Marines himself and a veteran, just back after 22 months with a raider battalion in the South Pacific, including 70 days at Empress Augusta Bay on Bougainville. Tell us about those 70 days, will you, John?
Well, we went in with a task force on November 1st. My battalion took an island that guards the entrance to the bay, while the main force went in and established a beachhead. But there were a lot of losses on shore, so my company was sent in later to reinforce another battalion. That night, my platoon was sent out through the lines with an artillery observer, and we stayed out there for the next 2 days while the observer directed the artillery fire. Things moved pretty fast, and the main line overtook us on the third day. That's when we got our first hot meal.
Well, had your platoon been involved in any heavy fighting up to that time? Incidentally, you were the platoon guide, weren't you?
No to the first question and yes to the second. But we saw plenty of fighting a few days later. The Japs sent a battalion over the mountains from Numa Numa to attack us. Our battalion had a little scrape with them the night of November 8th, and when we recovered the withdrawal of a company across Piva Creek. We met them the next morning, and I think that was the first time that two full battalions had taken part in a pitched battle out there. The Japs waited for us until they were about 20 yards away before they opened fire. You couldn't see them. You just had to let go when you saw something move in the jungle. Before that, though, our artillery had laid down a barrage. And incidentally, the artillery behind us was commanded by another uncle of mine, Lieutenant Colonel Raymond F. Crist.
Well, we know you won that fight, but what did you learn there about the Jap as a soldier?
They were good, all right, but they were not as good as Marines. They would scream and yell when they got hit. That's something I never heard a Marine do. They seemed to be downright scared. One time I saw a Jap officer get behind his men and try to drive them with his sword. A buddy of mine in charge of a machine gun got them all. In fact, he must have killed at least 30 of them that day.
Was that your biggest fight, John?
It was the hottest by far, but a couple of weeks later, the Japs sent a whole regiment up from Buka. But they were almost completely wiped out by artillery. That was the heaviest barrage I've ever seen. I was told later that our guns had fired 7,000 rounds in 20 minutes. We found 1,000 dead Japs, and most of the rest of them were dazed.
Well, how about the morale of our boys out there, John?
They don't like that word, for one thing. They're all right, and they don't want any sympathy. They would like to get more and straighter news. I had the impression that the whole country was tied up by strikes, and that nobody would get any gasoline or anything, or much of anything else.
Well, I wish we had time for more detail, but I want to add that in addition to Uncle Jimmy, who defended Wake, and Lieutenant Colonel Crist, who backed up John's battalion at Bougainville, John has a third uncle and two cousins in the Marines and two younger brothers who are now naval air cadets and plan to join the Marines. The Devereaux are like that. I return you to Admiral Radio in New York.
Once again, here is Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral Radio.
The interest in foreign broadcast reception has increased by leaps and bounds since the beginning of the war. When peace comes to, Americans will continue to be interested in first-hand news from abroad. Proud owners of Admiral Radios have been especially fortunate because their sets have Magna Band tuning, an exclusive Admiral engineering feature. Admiral's Magna Band is a separate circuit built right into the chassis, which separates every foreign station and enables the listener to tune each of them at its top performance. It makes both the logging and relocation of any foreign station easy and quick. With Admiral Magna Band tuning, you can get good reception of shortwave American broadcasts in sections of the country where reception of standard local broadcasts is difficult due to extremes in natural surroundings. When Admiral's wartime job is done and the world is at peace, Magna Band tuning will be incorporated in your new and better Admiral Radio, America's Smart Set, built by Admiral Corporation, the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonograph combinations with automatic record changers. The appearance of personnel of the armed services on this program does not constitute an endorsement of our product for the armed services. The United States Army needs wax. All women who are American citizens between 20 and 49 years of age and who are not in essential war work are urged to apply at the nearest U.S. Army recruiting station. Wax are now replacing men successfully in 239 different types of vital Army jobs, and thousands more wax are urgently needed to speed victory. So do your part. Volunteer for the WAC. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by the Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's Smart Set. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave, direct from leading news centers of the world. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.